Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Thousands gather at the Utah Capitol and other Utah cities for No Kings protests. As Utah grapples with closing schools, K through 12 enrollment sees the largest dip in 25 years. And visitors continue to flock to Zion National Park amid the government shutdown. Here's what's keeping it open. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune emerging news reporter Brock Marchant and reporter Brooke Larson. Right now, we bring in reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you on the program today. Let's start with the schools story. I guess the figures for this year's enrollment are out. How much did K through 12 drop?
Yeah, it's pretty dire. Dropped 1.7%, which is the equivalent of 11,478 students.
So, it's a lot. How does that compare to last year's? I think last year's was a drop as well.
Last year was a drop too, you're right. And at the time, that was also a historic drop, and it was 4,873 students. And so we have now tripled that historic downturn.
So where is this happening, and are there any places where enrollment's growing?
Yeah, so I would say that the drop is pretty much across the board, right? I mean, we're experiencing it really across all grade levels and across a lot of the school districts. So like Salt Lake City School District, Granite School District, Washington County School District all saw a 4.5% decline. There were two school districts, Beaver County and Tooele County, that saw growth above 1%, but those are the only two that grew more than that.
So I'll quote from your story. For the first time, Utah now has fewer students than it did when it saw its first drop during the COVID pandemic. So that is a pretty big drop.
Yeah, that's right. So that was in 2020. We had, obviously we had the pandemic, and that was kind of the first drop for 20 years in public K through 12 schools. And, you know, a lot of that was because kids were shifting to online schooling or homeschooling, and some of those students actually returned the next year. And so there was another bump, but now we've had 3 years of decline, and so it just hasn't made up the difference.
So why declining enrollment?
Yeah, it's, I think you'll kind of see the same things being pointed to in every state, declining birth rates, which is also affecting higher education too, kind of a slow, what they call in-migration, so people moving in the state, and increased school choice, so kids going, like I said, to like homeschooling or private schooling, and just kind of choosing a different path outside of the public system.
So the Utah Fits All voucher program, you mentioned in your story, that might be a factor?
Yeah, I think that's an easy place to point to. So Utah started this voucher program that gives money to families if they want to homeschool or private school their students. And, you know, a lot of kids have left the public system to pursue that, to get that money and to go elsewhere.
Now, enrollment dictates how much money districts get. So this is going to have an effect, on a lot of things, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the weighted pupil unit is essentially the formula that the state uses. It's based on like how many students you have, and it can be kind of increased if those students have special needs. But basically, simply put, you know, if you have a student, you get money for that student. And, with a decline by nearly 12,000 students, that's millions of dollars. It's a lot of money for the public system.
Granite School District is looking right now at closing two elementary schools. I imagine we'll see this pattern across most of the state. Hiring of teachers maybe slow down kind of thing?
Yeah, I think both of those are obvious kind of impacts from this. And yeah, like you said, Granite's already closing some schools. Salt Lake City School District has in recent years. And I think you'll just see that kind of grow and continue.
You note that even charter schools are feeling the pinch.
That's right. Yeah, typically when these numbers come out, you know, charter schools are always kind of the silver lining. And they did grow this year, to be fair, by 3.6%. They're 13% of the state's public school population, which is, you know, a pretty sizable chunk. But even so, they didn't see their best year on record. 44 of the state's 113 charter schools actually saw enrollment declines of 1% or more this year.
The state school superintendent does see a silver lining, you're right.
Superintendent Molly Hart, she says that the proportion of students who require specialized service in education, which includes like students with disabilities or those who are learning English for the first time, both of those populations, the proportion of them grew. So the silver lining for her is essentially that public schools are kind of this beacon for those who are the most in need in the state.
You know, the students of color now make up a slightly higher percentage in K through 12.
Yeah, it grew just a bit. This fall, students of color are 31.2% of the school population. Last fall, they were 30.6%. So just kind of a slight increase there.
Now, I guess Utah's voucher program hasn't released any demographic data, but in other states, predominantly white.
Yeah, for voucher programs.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Carmen Nesbitt, our K-12 reporter at the Tribune, has done just excellent work covering the voucher program. So I'd highly recommend you look at the stories that she has done. But yeah, there's not racial data for the vouchers, but typically other states that have run those and have released that data, they tend to support white students.
We're talking with Courtney Tanner, reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. Let's move to another story, very interesting story. Here's the headline: BYU is tearing down a building named after a slaveholder. Here's why and what comes next. We're talking about the BYU's administration building.
That's right. You have the Abraham O. Smoot Administration Building.
So tell me a bit about Abraham O. Smoot.
Yes, Abraham O. Smoot, he came to Utah with kind of the pioneer groups in 1847, and he served as the mayor of Salt Lake City for 10 years. And then there's this kind of fun quote from Brigham Young, who was the leader of the LDS Church, and basically asking Smoot to come to Provo and basically giving him a choice between Provo, Texas, and something I can't say on the radio. And it's kind of a joke, but and essentially Smoot moved to Provo and became mayor there too.
And Smoot owned slaves. I guess that's the rub here.
Yeah, that is the kind of the situation. Historians have tracked likely three total, and their names are Tom, Lucy, and Jerry.
So the Abraham O. Smoot has his name on this building, and there have been attempts over the years by various students and groups to take the name off, I guess.
So there was a pretty popular petition in 2020, if I'm remembering right, and there was the Black Student Union at BYU kind of had pushed this idea of basically renaming any buildings if they had a person's name on them. That person's name would essentially like be removed and the building would just be named for its function. So instead of like, for instance, the Abraham O. Smoot Administration Building, it would just be the Administration Building.
So they're going to tear down this building, build a new one. It'll just be known as the administration building, it sounds like. Do we know the current name of the building? Does that have anything at all to do with the decision to tear this one down?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting question. So, the spokesperson for BYU is kind of saying, at this point we don't know, but BYU does have a policy that it's been operating under in the last couple of years where if it builds a new building, it actually doesn't put a name on it. So it's redoing its art building currently, which was previously named for a former BYU president, and the new building is just the arts building. I also talked to the Abraham Owen Smoot Family Organization, who is kind of the legacy group that's kind of carrying on, the Smoot family tradition. And they said that they've been in talks with BYU, and BYU has basically like told them that like don't expect to see Abraham Smoot's name on the next building. So it does sound like the new construction won't carry that on.
Is anybody, any students, any groups speaking out about this?
At this point, I think that everyone's kind of seeing what happens, if that makes sense. The Smoot family, the organization, basically said, it's okay. We appreciate like how BYU is handling this, and they have, I guess, promised the family, BYU's promised the family that they'll honor Abraham Smoot in some other way. It's not really clear, exactly what that looks like at this point. I haven't really heard from students this time around. I reached out to some groups and, everyone's staying kind of quiet, but I would imagine that it's a positive thing for a lot of student groups that have been pushing this for years.
You talked to Paul Reeve. Tell me who he is and what he said.
Yeah, Paul Reeve is a really fantastic historian that works at the University of Utah, and he has written a book recently about kind of the legacy of racism within Utah and within the LDS Church. And he talked to me a little bit about the research that he specifically did on Smoot and kind of finding these records, essentially, that showed that Abraham Smoot had slaves in really just an interesting kind of situation, the documents that he found. One of them was a death certificate for a slave named Tom that basically said that he belonged to Abraham Smoot. And you can see all of his work. The book is called This Abominable Slavery, and if you go to thisabominableslavery.org, it has all of these documents that he and his co-authors have kind of come across as they've researched this. I mean, really worth a deep dive and digging into to kind of see, what Utah's real history is.
A couple of these slaves died before the abolishment of slavery, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, Tom that I mentioned before, he died in April 1862, and Jerry, another slave that they were able to trace to Abraham Smoot through an article in the Deseret News. Actually, that article was about Jerry's death in 1861. So, yeah, neither of them saw kind of the end of slavery. I guess it's also worth noting that Brigham Young, the leader of the church at the time, had actually supported slavery in the Utah Territory. So it's kind of unclear, I guess, exactly how that would have played out, how they survived, but kind of an interesting timeline.
I think you know in the story that at least some have suggested the entire university be renamed because of Brigham Young's, I guess, stated support for slavery.
Yeah, there was a really interesting op-ed that the Tribune ran in 2020. There was a lot of discussion on this in 2020, but there was this op-ed by kind of an activist and alum of the university who basically said, like, oh, maybe it's time to reconsider this given the history.
So Reeve, I think he would like to, I can't remember his exact quote, he would like to see something, a statement from the university, something, rather than just tearing the building down and not renaming it for Smoot.
Yeah, he had kind of an interesting perspective, essentially saying, just changing the name because you've rebuilt the building doesn't actually kind of address head on the issues here, right? I mean, you're kind of sidestepping any kind of acknowledgement of the harm of what this did. I mean, a lot of black students over the years at BYU have said, walking into this building is really painful. I'm a black student at BYU, and walking into this hurts, is what they've said, and it's really, an interesting part of this. And so, yeah, Paul Reeves' kind of thought is, you haven't even addressed the harm of this. And a lot of folks for years have asked, put a plaque outside. Put a plaque outside acknowledging the history of this man. And that never really came to fruition. And now the name will change, but it's kind of incidental that the name is changing.
So BYU's Black Student Union, I can't remember exactly when this was, they pushed for an effort to rename every building that had a name, I guess, to a no name, I guess. And that appears to be what BYU is doing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're not, BYU isn't retroactively kind of going back and taking names off. So there's still a lot of buildings on campus that will have names, right? But if BYU builds a new building, it doesn't put a name on it.
There's some photos in the story. Apparently, the Abraham O. Smoot administration building sign was vandalized at some point. The statue of Abraham Smoot.
It's a statue of Brigham Young, but it's
Oh, Brigham
nearby.
Young.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the Smoot administration building sign also. So at some point in 2020, in the summer, some vandals, I guess, went on campus and with some red paint and, kind of left their mark on these pieces.
You note, Courtney, in your story, there may be some other buildings named after some people who at least have maybe some problematic statements, at least, in their past.
Yeah, so the library at Brigham Young, it's named for a man who made some comments about interracial marriage that are a little unsavory, I guess, is the easiest way to put it. The law school is named for a man who advocated that the blood banks essentially segregate donations from black and white people. The BYU chemistry building is named for Ezra Taft Benson, and he suggested that civil rights for black people were, quote, a communist deception. And the campus field house is also named for a man who said that black individuals shouldn't be entitled to the full blessings essentially within the LDS church, and also made comments on interracial marriages. So there is kind of a legacy of folks who have buildings named after them at BYU. And I should note, you know, it's not only BYU that has this kind of history. A lot of universities across the country do, you know, I mean, there's a statue currently at the University of Utah, for instance, that a lot of folks are stressed about because it kind of honors someone that they question whether it should be honored or not. You know, I mean, this isn't just a BYU thing, but, you know, there is kind of a list here of folks that have said things and now have buildings named after them. And I think that's the concern that the Black Student Union was trying to raise, you know, is if you just take the names off every building, then you're not kind of singling out anybody, but you are at least kind of addressing the problem.
And so, as you know, BYU is not doing this retroactively, but it seems to be their policy going forward that it would adhere to what the Black Student Union wanted.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, they're not going back and pulling the names off of other buildings that still stand, but at least for new buildings that are built, they won't carry on that tradition.
Has BYU stated why they have this new policy?
They haven't. So that's kind of interesting. And I looked for a long time to try to figure out when it started. And I was kind of getting mixed answers. You know, some folks were suggesting it goes back as far as 2008. I think there's probably a really good connection to a report that came out in, I think it was 2021, maybe 2022, somewhere around there, that looked into racism on campus at BYU. A really interesting report that the university commissioned. And, you know, one of the suggestions in that was around building names. So it's possible it came out of that. But yeah, it's just been within the last couple of years, the university's kind of moved away from using individuals' names.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks so much for telling us about this.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom. It was great.
Thank you. Behind the headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune will continue after a break. Here's the headline we'll treat in the next segment. Thousands gather at the Utah Capitol and other Utah cities for No Kings protests. We'll be talking with emerging news reporter Brock Marchant. Hope you'll stay with us for Behind the Headlines. Thanks for joining us for Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and here is the headline we want to talk about. Thousands gather at the Utah Capitol and other Utah cities for the No Kings protests. And to talk about this, we bring in Salt Lake Tribune emerging news reporter Brock Marchant. Brock, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So all over the nation, of course, but here in Utah, you did some reporting on this along with some colleagues. What did the organizers say? I think some 14 Utah cities. How many did they think came out?
Yeah. So, you know, overall in Utah, I'm not sure on that number, but I do know in Salt Lake City at the Capitol, organizers were estimating at least 12,000, maybe more. I know that in Heber City, at least 1,000 came out. And then even in other rural areas where, you know, organizers didn't think they'd have maybe more than a handful of people, they had at least, you know, 20 or 30. An example of that would be in Fillmore, you know, a pretty small town comparatively, somewhere where organizers weren't sure how many people would come. They had at least a small group who came out to to support their messaging. So it was definitely a statewide endeavor. And people definitely came kind of everywhere, not just the places where someone might typically expect for a protest.
So you report on that nokings.org listed events at least being scheduled in places like Boulder and Kanab. So unlikely places, right?
There were 14 in all throughout the state. And yeah, definitely places where you might not expect it. Kanab, like you said, Boulder, Ephraim, as well as what you might expect. Salt Lake City, where there was a big one, Ogden, Logan had one around the city building or the county building. And so, yeah, definitely a lot going on throughout the state.
So in June, the No Kings protests at that point, people remember a gentleman was shot and killed in the during the Salt Lake City protest there. Did people mention that? Was there any trepidation?
It was something I asked people about in Salt Lake because I was wondering if that was on people's minds. And several of the people I talked to mentioned how it was definitely somewhat of a consideration in their choice to come, but it wasn't a large enough consideration to stop them from wanting to be there and from wanting to show dissatisfaction with President Donald Trump and his administration and different policy choices that they're implementing. So there definitely was the thought of, is this going to go better? And hopefully this will go better, though, among a lot of people. And that was something that organizers were aware of, too. We're only months after that fatal shooting happened at a No Kings protest. And it was something they took into account as they planned this protest at the Capitol. They wanted to do what they could to make sure people were comfortable. They wanted to try to keep a focus on joy and on unity among the people who came. And, as more and more people RSVP'd, they actually canceled a march part of the protest that they originally had scheduled. And talking to an organizer, Jamie Carter, she said that was in part because they were having so many people they weren't sure if their staff could accommodate. But it was also in part because they weren't sure people were ready to march again in Salt Lake City, given what had happened. So it was something people were definitely aware of, if not vocal about. But it didn't deter large numbers from coming to the Capitol.
This is, I think somebody in your story mentioned as well, we're only a little over a month removed from the killing of Charlie Kirk, right, in Orem. Did people talk about that at all?
It wasn't something I heard a lot about in Salt Lake. With this story, we were able to collaborate with other reporters through the Utah News Collaborative. But from what of their reporting, it definitely was a concern, at least among some groups of protesters, where, okay, we had the shooting at a protest in Salt Lake City, and then we saw this political violence in Utah not long ago either. Like you said, not very far removed. So that definitely was sitting on at least some minds as people came out.
So in general, the protests you were at, what was the mood? What was the vibe of people?
In the, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes before it officially started, people were kind of looking around, wondering if more people would come to the Capitol lawn, wondering if their numbers were going to be fewer. People told me they hoped more people would show up, and they definitely did. It really grew in those beginning minutes of the protest and right before. And that joyful atmosphere that organizers told me they were going for definitely seemed to be reflected. You had people in inflatable costumes dancing, and you had some signs that were very serious, and but you had some that were less serious and were definitely kind of funny and worked to kind of keep that focus on joy. You had upbeat songs with lyrics that had been posted so people could sing along if they wanted to. And you had a scheduled agenda of speakers who were set to share messages. So it was very organized. So I definitely think that they were able to achieve what they told me they were hoping to ahead of the protest, with making it feel like a welcoming atmosphere, making it feel like it's a united atmosphere, even among people who might have been at that June protest or might have thought about it. It was definitely a good energy among people who had gone.
One of the people I think you talked to, 80-year-old lady, what did she say?
Yeah, so she essentially told me I asked her the biggest reason she came, and she showed me her sign that essentially said, "I want my America back. I want the country that I knew before Trump's administration made these changes." She wanted it back, and I asked her what was kind of the breaking point for you. Why did you decide to come? What was the biggest reason? And she said that in studying, German history, right before or during the takeover of the Nazi Party, she saw similarities between what happened then and what's currently happening in the United States, and was concerned with that. And those concerns were enough to kind of be the tipping point to get her to come to the protest and to show her support for the No Kings movement.
What did other people say? What other people you talked to?
Yeah, so some were they were concerned with immigration. They themselves or their family or their friends were are concerned that they might be taken by ICE or deported or detained. And there was a lot of concern about that. While this shutdown, I think, just became the second longest in United States history, a lot of people were displaying signs about I'm a federal worker going unpaid, or they were a veteran worried about their benefits and worried about their health care, or people worried about insurance costs. So everyone there, or at least a lot of people there, definitely seem to be feeling what's happening on some personal level, whether it be through immigration concerns and worries about ICE movement in Utah, or whether it be financial concerns given rising costs, given the ongoing shutdown and what that can mean and the broader impacts, or other things that they think are results of the administration and their actions.
Were there any speakers speaking to the crowds?
Yeah. So there were several speakers who came. There was the president, I believe, of the Salt Lake City chapter of the NAACP. There was a teacher of the year for, I think it was the year 2021, among others. And they definitely kept in mind kind of the message of unity and the message of joy that the organizers were hoping to maintain. Yeah, I believe there were four or five overall.
So you quoted a gentleman named Adrian Rollins, who talked about his time serving in the U.S. Air Force in Iraq.
Yes. He was another speaker, and he addressed the crowd and said he did serve with the Air Force in Iraq, and he said it didn't take him long while he was there to realize he had more in common with the people he was fighting against than the corporations or politicians that he thought sent him there. And he was really speaking toward unity among workers and unity among the working class. So you had messages like his. You had a lot of messaging amongst just various positions, where he was advocating for the working class. Some others were advocating, worried about the loss of rights that they think minorities are facing right now, or that they worry minorities are facing right now. And you had others who really emphasized the importance of being informed and being active and being a participant in things that can help people show their support or show their dissatisfaction with what's happening in the country.
The report from Moab said that generally people were honking their horns, seemed to be in support of the protests. They reported one person who showed one finger was how they phrased it. I guess a bit of protest against the protests. Were there any counter protests where you were?
In Salt Lake, we had there were a few small groups who kind of came. I only personally saw, I want to say, like two or three counter protesters overall. So it really was not a very large group when considering the thousands of people who came in support of the protests. So there definitely were some. I didn't count too many individual fingers, but there definitely were people, like you said, who were protesting the protest. But not enough that it really touched the numbers of people who were there in support.
We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune Emerging News reporter Brock Marchant. Let's turn to another story, important story here. Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill is urging police statewide to adopt a uniform process they must follow in investigating domestic violence calls. Beginning of the story, Brock, you report that the district attorney says that investigators do a more consistent job with DUIs than with domestic violence cases. What does he want to see happen?
Yeah, so, in a news conference, kind of recognizing the challenges that victims of domestic violence face, as well as prosecutors working on these cases and police who investigate them, like you said, Sim Gill did mention and was concerned that throughout the state of Utah, if an officer is investigating a DUI, they follow set steps. They all go through the same proceedings in investigating that DUI. And he said that that consistency and following those best practices leads to better prosecutions overall, more consistent prosecutions overall. And his big concern is in Utah, while we have that for DUIs, we don't have a set of steps that officers responding to a domestic violence situation should follow. It varies from department to department and geographic location. And he's concerned that, you know, someone who might face those circumstances in one part of the state and be able to have a successful prosecution and be able to have a case that's going to bring justice to them. If that happened in a different area of Utah, he's worried they wouldn't see that simply because of where they live. And that's an issue that he thinks needs addressed. He talked about how within Salt Lake County, where he is the DA, he's implemented steps to make sure that officers from different agencies are communicating with each other, are discussing these best practices, and are making sure they're following these investigative steps to help prosecutors form the best case that they can in domestic violence situations.
No, I think he mentioned, at least you mentioned in your report, Utah's lethality assessment protocol that was established in 2023. I think he says that's great, but we need to go even further.
Yeah, he did. He said it's a good first step, but he would like to see a more consistent procedure for the investigating beyond that. The lethality assessment protocol, which is a set of steps that officers can follow to see, you know, how much risk someone might have from their partner in a domestic violence situation. It's been implemented for several years and it is a step in the direction he wants to see, but it doesn't fulfill what he thinks needs to be fulfilled in making sure that the investigative practices are entirely consistent.
Now, they got a grant, right? I guess his office, and they've set up a liaison, would you call this person?
Yeah, a liaison with his office, someone who had years of experience investigating domestic violence cases. And this person works with his office and then works with other police departments in Salt Lake County as well. They're with the Unified Police Department in the area. And like we talked about a little bit before, they set up meetings to discuss with officers and with other people who help investigate these incidents to decide what's working for people, what's not working for people. How can we train officers to, be more trauma-informed in their responses? And how can we make sure that they gather the information and evidence that's going to be helpful to prosecutors? A benefit that Sim Gill pointed out about taking steps like this is that in the case that somebody doesn't want to testify against their abuser or they don't want to cooperate with prosecutors, he said if at that initial crime scene investigators can gather important or vital information, then they can still put together a case where if they do not, and if they entirely rely on that person who then backs out, you know, they might not have a solid prosecution against them. So he said it's really important in that aspect to help victims and to make sure that people committing crimes are taken to justice.
Finally, Sim Gill gave a very impactful story near the end of your story. He said, I'm quoting him, we have this mindset, well, if you're in an abusive relationship, why don't you just leave? Then he told a story about a case that I guess he handled where the victim wanted to leave but did not, for a kind of a surprising reason to me anyway.
Yeah, he said it really surprised him at the time, because he was talking, trying to see if they would testify, trying to confirm what had happened in this domestic violence situation. And he was surprised when they eventually told him, yes, it has happened. You know, I've been physically abused by this person, and it probably will happen again. And they told him, I stay with this person because my kids need health coverage. It surprised him and also helped him to realize, well, okay, if we can get this person's kids' health coverage, if that's why they're staying in this relationship, then maybe we can help them out of the relationship. Maybe we can help them, you know, moving forward. And he talked about how that's how, you know, trauma-informed responses can take place, where it's recognizing that need, recognizing the boundaries someone might face in this relationship or in their situation, rather than just thinking, why don't you just leave? Where that's often too simple in these cases. So yeah, it's definitely, I think a really good example of the challenges that officers are facing and that prosecutors are facing in these complex cases.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune emerging news reporter Brock Marchand. Thanks for telling us about these stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Following a break, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Here's the headline. Visitors continue to flock to Zion National Park amid the government shutdown. Here's what's keeping it open. We'll have that following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. At this part of the program, we're bringing in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Here's the headline. Visitors continue to flock to Zion National Park amid the government shutdown. Here's what's keeping it open. So we want to talk about that, and also some flooding in Washington County as well. Of course, the government shutdowns, I've lost count, 3 weeks in or something. What's the situation at Zion? How many of the workers are still working?
Yeah, I don't have a number on how many workers are still working, but I will say across the parks, it's generally kind of emergency staff they've kept on, such as first responders, firefighters for suppression work, as well as I know at Zion, they've kept on custodial staff because that, you know, counts as a public health need. And thanks to funding from the state and nonprofit Zion Forever Project, they've also been able to keep on some park rangers to keep the visitor center open.
So the state has kicked in some money, I think, for all five to keep mm-hmm. the visitor centers open. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yep. So the state is giving the Interior Department $8,000 per day to keep visitor centers open across Utah's five national parks.
And then Zion Forever, what is that?
So that's a nonprofit, Zion's nonprofit partner. A lot of national parks across the country have a nonprofit partner that's basically formed to help fundraise, educate, you know, get information to visitors about the national park, just recognizing our parks do have limited funding. They're not always able to meet the needs just with federal funds. So these nonprofit partners help step in beyond just government shutdowns, but throughout the year.
So I learned this. I'm still not sure I understand completely why, but during a shutdown, national parks can't accept entrance fees?
Yep, that's the case. So, you know, Zion's losing out on and all national parks are losing out on a lot of money. Zion at this point has probably lost over $1 million in revenue from entrance fees. I talked with Natalie Britt, the CEO of Zion Forever Project, about a week and a half ago now, and She estimates the park is losing about $35,000 to $50,000 per day in entrance fees, given the park is still having roughly 20,000 visitors a day. Last I heard the numbers, so that's a lot of money they're losing. Those fees go to cover things like the shuttle system in Zion. So the impacts of this shutdown will likely be felt for months, if not years, just because of that lost revenue.
Zion Forever is accepting donations. I guess that will help a bit, but it's not making up all of the entrance fees, I guess.
Put up at the visitor center that asks for donations. There's a QR code on there that people can scan, and people have been donating. When I talked to Natalie Britt with Zion Forever last week, she said visitors have donated roughly $1,200 to $2,200 per day since the shutdown began. So, some people are donating, but that's pretty shy of what the park could be bringing in with entrance fees.
I'm not sure if it's the state or someone is funding the wilderness desk, right? That's important. Get permits so that if something happened at one of those sites, rescuers would know who's out there.
So that is being funded through the state funds, and from my understanding, they identified that as a priority to keep open just because Zion is about 85% wilderness. And so a lot of those areas, are backcountry areas. They're more remote. You need permits to camp or hike in some of those places. And those permits help search and rescue know where people are in the park. So if someone does go missing, they have a smaller area where they will focus their search and rescue efforts versus having to look throughout the whole park.
So, the visitor experience somewhat close to normal at this point.
That is what I've heard from people I talked to in the park. I visited, let's see, not this past Friday, but the previous. So, about a week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago. And so things could be different now if I went out today, but a couple weeks ago, I just walked up to various people outside the visitor center, and every single one told me that, it had been a positive experience. They didn't really notice much different, given not everyone that was there had been designed before to really be able to compare. But I did not hear stories about, serious issues people were noticing.
You quote Representative Blake Moore in the story. He gave an interview to the Tribune. He says if the shutdown drags on for another couple of weeks, things are going to get pretty bad. I'm not sure if he's referring just to the parks or just in general.
That was just in general. Yeah, we have a link to the story where that came from with the Tribune earlier this month as well. So he was speaking to the shutdown more broadly. And that just Utahns may see this at various levels, whether it's the park or something else.
So, gateway towns are still doing well, I think. Springdale, for example, hotels, restaurants, a lot of visitors coming. But the park employees, many of them are on furlough, right? Not getting paid.
Yeah, so when I was up at Zion a couple weeks ago, I did talk with the mayor of Springdale, Barbara Bruno. And she said, from what she's hearing from the local businesses in town, that the hotels and restaurants have stayed busy. They haven't seen a lot of cancellations or anything like that. I saw hotels with no vacancy signs up, and so it does seem, at least when I was there a couple weeks ago, again, I want to say things could be different. I haven't heard of dramatic changes. It seems like the park's still staying really busy. So the town itself seems to be doing okay, usual visitation rates. But yeah, in Springdale and the other towns surrounding Zion are also park employees who are furloughed and not getting paycheck, and they are starting to worry, from what I hear.
We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson on Behind the Headlines. I want to turn to another story. Here's the headline. Washington County declares emergency as flood recovery begins. We're talking about Pine Valley. Where is Pine Valley?
Yeah, so Pine Valley is in southwest Utah, about 40 minutes kind of north of St. George, 40-minute drive.
So they had flooding there. The I guess the bigger problem is they had a big fire there, right? They have a big burn scar, which exacerbates the flooding. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so in Pine Valley, the Forsyth fire burned in the mountains around the town. That's a Dixie National Forest there, but the fire also went into the town. You know, 13 homes were destroyed in the blaze. So it was one of the more intense destructive fires Utah saw this past summer. And now the town is dealing with the aftermath of that. When these intense fires come in, they, you know, creates kind of a hydrophobic soil in the areas that were really burnt, which means the water just rushes off of the soil. And with that, it takes, you know, fallen trees, branches, sediment. So instead of that rain seeping into the soil, it's just rushing off and creating these flood conditions.
There's also they're trying to build a reservoir out there. How did this affect that?
So that reservoir is in a different part of Washington County, Chief Toker Reservoir. That's something the Washington County Water Conservancy District is working on. And there was some sediment that was washed into that dam and reservoir site that they're building. But I checked in with the district and they said it caused pretty minimal damage. So not something too substantial, but just another area of the county that did see some impact.
Will there be government money to help rebuild infrastructure and homes and such?
To rebuild infrastructure, yes. I should say infrastructure to kind of rehabilitate the watershed. You know, the county has been doing some repairs and putting some of their own resources as well as the state, but county and the Forest Service has also received federal funds to help with this rehabilitation, in part because this Pine Valley community, you know, is right up to the edge of the National Forest. Where the fire started is National Forest land. So the National Forest is working on flood mitigation work, you know, reseeding hillsides. They'll be taking down a lot of the burnt trees, things like that, in the months and really years to come. And then the county has also received money from the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They have this program called Emergency Watershed Protection, where they work with counties or municipalities that have, you know, experienced an emergency such as a fire or flood to help with repair and rehabilitation work to help that community be more resilient going forward. So that will fund things like detention ponds that will catch sediment and debris. So if a flood happens again, hopefully these ponds, once they are constructed, will collect some of that debris flow and they won't flow into some of the culverts and channels that was part of the issue a couple weeks ago, is the channels and culverts that do exist in Pine Valley got just clogged up with sediment. And so if these detention ponds are able to catch some of that, hopefully the other infrastructure will hold up and be able to do their job better.
Finally, Liz, you mentioned years. How long do they estimate think it will take for things to get back to normal?
Yeah, I mean, the Forest Service has told me they estimate at least 3 to 5 years in terms of just the watershed stabilizing, you know, the flood risk reducing. So Pine Valley could be at risk for these flash floods during serious storms or spring runoff for the next 3 to 5 years. But I mean, it will take the forest Some of those trees that are lost are 100-year-old trees, so the campground is going to look pretty different than what people are used to for a long time.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And you have been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.